Overnight, a gunfight erupted between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians in the southern Gaza Strip. One Palestinian has reportedly died. It has been a violent week, again, in the Middle East. Israeli tanks briefly moved into the Palestinian-controlled town of Jenin in the West Bank. Dan Shore is on vacation, so our friend John Heilman of Wired Magazine joins us to review the week's news. John's at member station WBUR in Boston this morning. John?
Morning, Scott.
U.S. Envoy David Satterfield has been in the Middle East this week, and he's been trying to promote the idea of a ceasefire. Both sides so far seem confirmed in their policy, or perhaps lack of policy. Has all this bloodshed resulted in no change?
I think that the situation is, in fact, incredibly grim, and I think it's getting grimmer seemingly every day. I mean, I think it comes as news to no one that we face an incredibly bleak outlook. When Ariel Sharon spoke to President Bush this week on the telephone, they had a brief conversation, and he told the president that he had no intention of letting the conflict escalate into a full-blown Mideastern war. But the truth, I think, is that, you know, to many, at least untrained eyes, the Israelis and the Palestinians are already effectively at war. In the year or so since the peace process broke down and violence erupted, some 500 Palestinians and 150 Israelis have been killed. We see Palestinian suicide bombers engaged in routine acts of extreme terror and Israeli countermeasures that are the sorts of things one typically sees under martial law. And yet, as harsh as those countermeasures are, this week we see also a Gallup poll which came out showing that more than 70% of Israelis have no confidence that the measures that Sharon is practicing will be enough to halt the violence. And that shift in public opinion is in itself, I think, a worrying trend. I remember visiting Israel back in 1993 when the peace process had just kicked in and being told by many politicians how the Israeli public was increasingly not just demanding peace but expecting peace, and that as those expectations built, so did the chances of achieving peace. Now I think exactly the opposite dynamic has taken hold, a terrible sort of downward spiral that's incredibly vicious and incredibly depressing.
Let me ask about the U.S., not just interest, but participation in it, because the Bush administration has been under some criticism for not being more involved. Egypt's foreign minister was, in fact, in Washington, D.C. this week, urging the administration to become more involved. President Bush says he's not indifferent, but also not naive, and that you can't promote a peace if the two parties or more than two parties aren't willing.
Well, I think that, you know, what's going on here, Scott, I think is, you know, you will recall during the campaign last year, George Bush claimed that he would fashion a foreign policy that was less activist, less interventionist, and more restrained than the one that was practiced by the Clinton-Gore administration. And in fact, though he didn't say this explicitly, he was also really conveying the sense that he would practice a foreign policy that was different from that of his father, who practice a very traditional Republican, internationalist, kind of multilateralist foreign policy, which is typified, of course, in the Middle East by his conduct of the Gulf War, but also manifested itself in his approach to Israel. We often associate the peace process of the 1990s with the Clinton administration, but it was, of course, predicated on diplomacy practiced by George Bush Sr. Yeah. and by Republican-appointed diplomats like Dennis Ross. So now you have a situation where George Bush is trying to stick, I think, to the principles he laid out on the campaign trail. But I think he's quickly discovering how hard that is, as so many new presidents before him learned. Foreign policy isn't formed on the campaign trail, and it's not formed in a vacuum. It takes shape on the world stage, where there are a lot of actors who very much want the United States to play an active role in global conflicts. And that's what this call this week from the Egyptian foreign minister is about. And I think that those calls will become more intense if the situation does indeed worsen, as it looks like it will.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about another part of the world stage. There are about 400 British troops in Macedonia this weekend who are preparing to see if the people there will support a ceasefire and then move in, I guess, 3,500 troops. Does this so far seem like a plan that seems to be working?
Well, you know, the reports from Macedonia are that the ceasefire, which took in effect on Monday, is tentative, it's unsteady. But you can't help but be shocked by how fast it has all unfolded. I mean, this ceasefire was signed on Monday. There were some terms that were stipulated. People wondered if it would take weeks or even months before the sides would agree to those terms. In fact, instead, by Wednesday, the Macedonian government had agreed to give amnesty to the Albanian guerrillas, and the Albanian guerrillas had agreed to disarm. And the NATO troops, at least the first part of the larger contingent, was on its way in. I think there are two reasons why it's happened so quickly. One is that the Macedonian majority really desperately wants peace. They believe that many of the demands of the Albanian minority could have been resolved without any of this violence that's gone on for the last 6 months. I think on the guerrilla side, they think they're going to get a good deal, and not just in terms of the amnesty, but what they have demanded, which is greater representation of Albanians on the police force and in the military and so on. There are doubts, of course, among the Macedonian majority about whether the guerrillas will in fact live up to their side and will disarm, whether it will seem It will actually play out as simply and easily as it seems it might. But the leaders of the guerrilla movement in interviews this week said that if the government makes good their side of the agreement, they will too. And we will just have to watch and see. The proof will be in the pudding there. Mm-hmm.
John, how's the economy doing? And I ask you because Republicans and Democrats seem to be reading from, different pages or even different ledgers?
Yeah, or different languages, different books, whole different disciplines. I've said on this program before, and I will say again, that it is clear that certain parts of the economy are experiencing very difficult times. They are actually in recession. The technology industry, which is the industry I know best, is certainly in that position. The manufacturing industry and sector is also like that. We saw Ford yesterday saying it's going to lay off 5,000 people and cut back its production of automobiles. At the same time, there's lots of other sectors of the economy that are doing really well. The housing sector continues to boom. I was at a home builders conference, if you can believe that, a couple weeks ago, and all across the country, the home builders are still building like it was the peak of the late 90s boom. Mm-hmm. I think the truth about the economy is that we'll probably end up this year having grown by somewhere between 1.5% and 2%. Not spectacular growth, certainly not boom time growth, but not terrible growth. We're certainly not in recession, at least not yet. And the kind of consensus forecast is for about 2.5% growth next year. I think that the bottom line is that the economy's kind of fair to middling, but politicians don't like to hear that. The ones who are out of office want to portray the economy as in the tank, and the ones who are in office want to portray it as doing better than it really is.
John, you're speaking with us from Boston this week, but you live in the Bay Area ordinarily. It must be great to be a baseball fan out there this summer. You have the advance of Barry Bonds on a home run record, conceivably. He's now that he's hit 53. And you have the Seattle Mariners out on the same coast who are in a pace to break the New York Yankees single-season victory record. What do you make of this, and should we be more excited throughout the rest of the country?
Well, I think, it is great. It's, you also have the Arizona Diamondbacks. I don't want to forget my friends down south who are having a really great season. Luis Gonzalez is playing baseball, chasing. He's got, 45 home runs also.
Could be the Triple Crown winner, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, just amazing. The whole West Coast is alive with great baseball. I think that, if it signifies anything, it signifies that, back to 1998, the year of the great Maguire-Sosa race, that was a home run race. That was the year that supposedly brought baseball back. And I think that this year we have a confirmation that that was not a fluke. There's pennant races all over the country. Even your Cubs seem to be
doing pretty well. Clinging to first place by a single point this morning.
Yeah, it's miraculous, and the Seattle Mariners are playing extraordinary baseball without their superstars that they gave away over the course of the last 3 years. I think that there's lots of reason to be excited, and I think that maybe as the season starts to really climax, you'll see a lot more excitement on the national stage here.
Okay. John, talk to you again. Take care. God bless.
Sure thing, Scott.
John Heilemann of Wired Magazine speaking with us from WBUR in Boston.